It came about a week ago, back from being at Spirit Rock for the entire month. Is the sound level okay?
Mm-hmm. Is that recording?
Okay. Being at Spirit Rock for the entire month, I was part of the team of teachers working with people for the month of March. We had about 25 people who were there for 2 months, and we were seeing them the second month, and about 60 people there for the month of March. And I was very inspired by that experience, which I've done a few times before, and was thinking that it was really a wonderful environment to support a way of practicing, which I wanted to talk about this evening. And it's a way that I've come to think of as taking every moment as part of a learning process. Taking everything in our experience as learning. And what I want to do this evening is to bring out that theme as one of the ways that we frame our lives and we frame our practice. Talk about some of the reasons why it's difficult to do that. Why we typically want to divide our experience into good experiences and bad experiences. Bad experiences I just want to get rid of. I do not want to learn from them. Right? And good experiences, actually I don't want to learn from them either. I just want them to stay. So you see the predicament we're in. And yet, there actually can be learning from everything. So it's actually, on one level, obvious, right? Why not take life as learning? What a model. What a beautiful way to frame things. And yet, it's difficult. So I want to talk about a little bit about that way of approaching our life and our practice. Talk about a few reasons why it's difficult to take that approach. And then talk about some of the supports that we need to really have that approach get stronger in our lives. That's my theme. Along the way, I'll tell some stories and read some poems. One of the reasons that I was thinking of this theme was a conversation I had a few days ago with a student who's been practicing maybe 30 years. And she was recently diagnosed, she's 75, she was recently diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. And we were talking just a few days ago, and she was saying that she could see that her initial reaction was basically to take this as a curse. Part of what we tend to do with experience is we say either it's a curse or a blessing. Either it's bad or it's good. And she was tending to take this as a curse. Her mind went to worst case scenarios, which you could imagine, such as I am living alone now. In some time I won't be able to live alone anymore. I'll have to go to a horrible nursing home. And she was scaring herself with that story. And she, as she looked more deeply, because I think she noticed that she was getting stuck with that storyline, something else started happening, which I think is the fruit of many decades of practice, which is that she basically kept inquiring. She knew, oh, I'm getting stuck, I'm telling myself scary stories. I've seen myself do that before. Let me just keep looking. Let me keep inquiring, which is really the spirit of taking something as learning, even something difficult like that diagnosis. And she came to see, oh, I've actually had the idea that I'm one of those special ones who never gets sick. And she hadn't been for 75 years, very much. I don't get sick. I'm special. I'm not like other people. And she found that she could see that she had had that belief, as it were. And she could see how that in some ways was comforting, but in other ways it separated her from others. And maybe it led her to have less compassion when someone else was ill, you know, there in that class of people who get ill. Maybe they're morally not quite up to snuff. You know? And do you know that idea sometimes? We sometimes have the sense, I don't know, it probably has roots in age-old religious beliefs that those who have problems are cursed by God or something like that, right? Or that there's some problem and that those who are the good ones don't have such problems. There may be such beliefs, you know, I don't think that holds up too long under scrutiny, but people have those ideas. And she found that as she inquired, she actually came to learning, appreciation, and of course she came to more compassion, both for herself and for others, and for the human situation, the human predicament in which we do have difficult experiences happen at times. In other words, she took that situation not simply as a curse, but something that she could work with, inquire into, and learn from, and have actually important insights that deepened her own self-understanding and deepened her compassion. All that from a diagnosis. And of course, there actually is a lot also that one can do with that diagnosis. I have a person I know very well who's had Parkinson's for 10 years, and for whatever reason, he's done large amounts of yoga and meditation, and it hasn't really deteriorated in 10 years. So, you know, that's not to say that will always happen, but there are options. So there was, she could really learn from that. Where I was thinking of another situation in my own life where I was once, as many of you know, I had a period in my life for 7 years where I was a university teacher, or college and university, and I taught in philosophy departments in Kentucky and Ohio. I was actually at the University of Kentucky. So, of course, I'm a little bit in mourning because of the basketball games from yesterday. Some of you, that might be an unknown to some of you, but for others, there was a NCAA Final Four that Kentucky is often in. Anyway, I had to, when I taught there, as a sidebar comment, when I taught there, I had to definitely arrange my teaching schedules around the basketball schedule. Okay, that's another story. So I was teaching there, and I was sort of a young teacher, and I was invited to be part of a group of people who were trying to look, you know, philosophy used to be the place in Western culture where the cultivation of wisdom was most central. In fact, literally, it means love of wisdom, the very word. And it had sort of deteriorated in most of our eyes, you know, of my eyes, to something where it became technical and people in colleges and universities trying to show how smart they are, but kind of losing the larger sense of wisdom. And so there were a group of people who were funded, who had a grant to get together over 3 years and try to bring back the deeper essence of philosophy to Western culture. Ambitious project. I was invited to be part of that. I was one of the younger people there. There were people that some of you know, like Houston Smith, Jacob Needleman, who I think still teaches at San Francisco State. Probably some of you studied with him, I imagine. Susan Griffin was part of it. Charlene Spretnak. A lot of wonderful people were part of the project. And one of our first gatherings, we discovered that these were wonderful people. Many of them had a deep spiritual practice connected with their reflection on deep issues. But when we actually got together and have differences of views, people seemed to be getting at each other in ways not so much different from anyone else. In other words, they didn't seem to be so skillful with dealing with someone's views who were different. Dealing with someone's views, someone who had different views. Okay. Just my English teacher, Ms. Baker, was saying, that is a problematic grammar. You should correct that a little bit. She's on my shoulder sometimes. Anyway. I and others were surprised that, we would have these lofty discussions, which sometimes tend to degenerate into, how could you think that? And people would, this is like basically one of the ways that we don't take everything as learning, right? When we interact with people who have different views. And it was somewhat painful to witness, with these wonderful people, famous, well-known people, who were seemed to be getting a little bit cranky and small before my eyes. And so at that point, one person who was in the group, named Robert McDermott, some of you may know him, he later became president of California Institute of Integral Studies, and he made a suggestion, is it possible to take a difference of views as the starting point for a learning process, rather than the starting point for war? Pretty amazing. And he said, here's how to do that. Here's how to take this practice. So this is something you can do. We can do, do this next week. So he invited us to, when we noticed a difference of views, first of all, notice that there's a difference of views. Maybe notice I'm getting a little reactive. I'm, thinking, how can that person think that? Whether it's political views, that's where it often happens, or any kind of views. Any kinds of opinions, positions, views, understandings. He said, when you notice a difference of views, take it as a starting point for inquiry. You can ask questions like, why am I so reactive about this other person's views? Or view? Is there something in my background that maybe I had a difficult experience with someone with that view? Is there anything that I might learn from this person? Is there anything I might possibly learn from this person? Can I really not go into a fixed position of opposition, but look carefully? And look carefully in that process doesn't mean I give up my view, but I resist going to that polarized, warlike antagonism. And that's been very influential. That's another way, and a very important part of our life, of taking everything as learning. How can I take as learning when I have different views? One of the models which Philip Moffitt has really helped with at Spirit Rock is in urging us to develop the sense that most basically we are a learning community. What is it like to take a community or a place of work or a family as dedicated most deeply to learning? And Philip has been very, very helpful in reminding us of this model, which originally was found in organizational life. And there have been people who want to take it even further and say, can we be an organization that's guided by the model of transformational learning? That actually what we want to hold, the vision that we want to hold our life in this community or this organization with, is the sense that we are here to be transformed, to learn, to keep learning. And can we take difficulty, particularly take conflict, as an opportunity to learn? Now, this is difficult. Right? This is challenging. We often, as I've mentioned, have an energy that makes us take everything as either good or bad, as either pleasant or unpleasant, as either a blessing or a curse. And we have deep habits and deep grooves in our minds and our neural pathways that would have us do that. Is this good for me? Is it bad for me? We know the teaching in Buddhist tradition about feeling tone. The second foundation of mindfulness, the second training about how to be mindful says, look very, very carefully at the quality of experience in terms of whether something is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Why is that important to look carefully at? It's because if we don't look carefully when something is pleasant, we will tend to want it and grab hold of it, whether it's a pleasant experience, a pleasant relationship, a pleasant taste, a pleasant sensation. When there's not awareness and wisdom, the habitual conditioning of something pleasant will lead to grasping. Similarly, the habitual conditioning around something unpleasant will lead to not wanting, pushing away. We would call both of those being reactive, being unconscious. And the way I've said it, it may sound more harmless, but the way this is in practice, it means that something unpleasant occurs in a conversation. Someone says something I don't like, and I just react right back without thinking, right? When there's not awareness, we are bound by our reactions. Something happens I don't like, I'll just react. I'll judge, I'll blame, I'll push away. I may judge or blame myself. We know that, right? That's one of my favorite cartoons that brings this out in the context of meditation. I brought this in. It shows a young woman meditating, and she says, today I will live in the moment, unless the moment is unpleasant, in which case I will eat a cookie. That kind of captures it, right? So meditation is for calm and comfort. And when something difficult happens, I'm not into learning. I'm into cookies. Right? And yeah, and so very, 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 very common pattern. So let me just ask here, what kind of situations for you make it difficult for you to take a particular experience as part of a learning process? When does your interest in learning shut down? And I'll just maybe ask people to give like a sentence or two response. Maybe think about it for a moment. What, for you, what kind of situations are difficult for you to take as learning? Okay, and see if you can formulate it in one or two sentences so we can hear from a few people, please. And I'll, should we use the microphone?
I don't know. Do we need it?
Yeah.
I'll try first. I've had situations involving my siblings and my family origin, especially that, you know, we're adults, difficult to mediate without falling back into.
Yeah. So family situations, particularly with siblings, where we get where there are strong tendencies to go into very old patterns, right? And you know, I guess the implication is I do that as well. I'm not interested in learning. I'm just playing out some drama. The script was written like 30, 40, 50 years ago. In spite of my best efforts to keep aware, bring compassion, that's hard.
Right. The speed of the interactions sometimes is such that choice and consciousness kind of diminishes.
Right. Yeah. So. Yeah. Thanks for pointing that out. Choice and consciousness diminish. And of course, to take something as learning, we need to have some awareness and then actually, at times, a choice. Should I go down the old road or should I try to approach this as learning. Maybe a few others, please. Why don't we also say our names as we're speaking?
Linda.
Yeah.
I have difficulty, or I start to not learn when I feel like the, say, argument I'm putting forth is the logical thing to do, and for some reason the other person just is not seeing the logic of it and chooses to go another route.
Yeah, so it's hard to take something as learning when I have presented my clearly worked out logical case and the other person, out of some failure of morality or intelligence.
Character weakness.
Clearly, you know, someone requiring therapy.
But I have just spent 4 days with my 97-year-old mother and trying to work through things with her.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what I think is right for her is not necessarily what she thinks is right for her.
Yeah. Great. So,
amazing.
So again, so it seems, so it could be family situations or people who don't share our views. Please, let's again say our name.
When my existence,
yeah,
the existence of women, the rape or mutilation of women, when I find that the notion of your freedom ends where my nose begins, totally breaks down, I find I lose my compassion.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a... I lose my adulthood.
Yeah.
Everything I've learned melts because I don't know how to deal with someone who comes to me with that kind of reasoning and behavior. So whether they're from the Middle East or whether they're from around the corner, I don't know what world they're living in.
Yeah, so situation where someone seems to have both very different view and behavior that's particularly oppressive towards women in this situation. Yeah. Thank you. Very hard to take that as learning, take that situation as learning. Maybe one or two more, please.
I'm Mary, and when I'm really invested in a particular plan, I mean, just simple stuff, I mean, not big things, but just when I'm invested in how we should do something.
Yeah. So it's hard for me to take something as learning when I'm really, let's say, invested, or we might say, you didn't use this word, but let me know if it's corresponding to what you're saying. Attached?
Mm-hmm. Attached, yes.
Attached to a particular plan,
yes,
view.
Yes.
It's very hard to take this as learning because my agenda should clearly prevail.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. How many can relate to that? How many can relate to some of the others? Yeah, I think, maybe one more. Please, Corey.
I'm Corey, and when I feel like I'm being criticized, and for whatever reason, I'm taking it really personally.
Mm-hmm.
Very difficult.
So, certain kinds of criticism bring out a certain personal reaction. And it's very hard to say, yes, I'm dedicated to learning. Let me take this as feedback. How many can relate to that? Yeah, criticism, very hard. I mean, we explore this a lot in the teachings on judgmental mind, right? It's very hard, and yet it could be valuable. So what helps us to actually take experiences, including difficult ones, as opportunities for learning? And I want to point out that I think what the situations that were mentioned are, in terms of what I sometimes like to call degree of difficulty, if we liken it like to the degree of difficulty of an Olympic diver from 0 to 10, most of what was mentioned probably is at 10 or right around there. So that's important to know. So people were mentioning very difficult situations that many or most or all of us would find quite difficult. And part of what helps us to take increasingly all situations as learning is to recognize the degree of difficulty and know when we're dealing with tens and know when we're dealing with sixes or fives. And actually, a lot of our learning will occur when we can take not the most difficult situations as learning. You know, I remember having a discussion with a close friend where we went very quickly to an extreme. You know, we were talking about, I don't know, compassion or love, and someone said, well, what about Hitler? You know, going to the extreme thought experiment that people sometimes go to with these kind of discussions. And for me at that time, it actually didn't work. I couldn't go there easily. So we can know that there are high levels of degree of difficulty, and a lot of our learning of this principle is actually not going to occur hanging out with the tens, and those may still be really, really hard, but we're going to learn about this with the threes and fours and fives and sixes. And how can we start taking those situations as learning experiences? How can I take this challenge or this difficulty with a coworker, which actually isn't at the level 10. It doesn't approach the level of triggering that might be there in our family, in the family, in some families, or with, I think, kind of extreme views that your name in the back, about your name was?
Arthur.
Arthur, that Arthur was pointing to. I think we can go towards that. You know, it's like when we practice loving kindness, remember? We actually try to get the loving kindness going where it flows the best, where it flows the easiest, and only later do we bring the practice to high degrees of difficulty. And actually, we only go to a so-called difficult person and bring care and compassion to that person after some time in the training, right? So we don't train first with the most difficult situations, just like the Olympic diver doesn't train at level 10, but trains, goes up towards that, right? It's a very important principle. A lot of what really can help us with taking this principle are both certain understandings and certain practices. I think it can be helpful to see that the basic model of taking everything as learning rests on an understanding that the problem of in life, really, the problem of why there's violence or suffering is primarily, or the root problem is ignorance. You know, and so that's, again, it also can be a learning process to see how does that apply with the most difficult situations. But we can see from the teachings of the Buddha as well as a lot of really Western approaches that this approach in which we take learning as central rests on an understanding that the core difficulty in human life is somehow that we don't see clearly. We don't see ourselves, we don't see others clearly. You know, we somehow don't know ourselves. From the 8th century, Shantideva, who wrote A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, says, "This world is confused with insanity due to the exertions of those who do not understand themselves." And so, again, that's the basis. But on a practical level, we want to find, you know, just use this as an approach to situations. I love that practice of working with different views, right? And how do I, that's very, very practical. You can do that as an experiment. Take working with someone's views who are different than yours and say, let me learn from this. Let me continue to learn. Now, a lot of what's going to make this possible is a high degree of awareness and mindfulness. Like your name in the back, we're talking about your...
Leslie.
Like Leslie was saying, when she was triggered or became reactive, awareness and choice go out the window. Or I remember studying with the spiritual teacher Ram Dass, and he said, when family issues are concerned, my spiritual practice goes out the window. That's what he said. You know, there's someone with 30, 40 years practice, he says. Or another way to say it, it makes things difficult. And so the starting point, again, working not with the most difficult ones, working in the realm where things are workable. Right? Very key aspect of practice. So choosing the situations at work, maybe with family, with drivers, where everything becomes something to learn from. Can you take that where things are not extreme, not the most difficult, but where they're workable? Good practice, like working with different views, is a wonderful practice to start with. We need a certain amount of mindfulness. We need, what this is really about is saying that we can move away from that tendency to categorize everything as either good or bad, and rather see, let me take the attitude of learning continually, over and over. Let me have a sense of, I think this should happen this way, but let me be open to explore. So it requires a radical openness. It requires knowing the tendencies of the mind to go to a fixed view, to go to reactions, and somehow suspend these reactions. It requires kind of a radical openness to experience, which is typically not so common, right? And we cultivate this in meditation. There's a beautiful poem, which I really like, from Naomi Shihab Nye, which is about her experience waiting for a delayed airline departure. It's called Gate 4A. Let me read this. This is about a kind of openness to experience. And not, again, it's like, can I be open? Because the attitude of learning requires openness. It requires not having our minds peg everything instantly into some category. Wandering around the Albuquerque airport terminal after learning my flight had been detained 4 hours, I heard an announcement. I should say Naomi Shihab Nye is a Palestinian-American poet. Some of you know her poetry, quite wonderful. I heard an announcement. If anyone in the vicinity of Gate 4A understands any Arabic, please come to the gate immediately. Well, one pauses these days, she said. Gate 4A was my own gate. I went there. An older woman in full traditional Palestinian embroidered dress, just like my grandma wore, was crumpled to the floor, wailing loudly. Help, said the flight service person. Talk to her. What is her problem? We told her the flight was going to be late, and she did this. I stooped to put my arm around the woman and spoke to her haltingly. Shudawa. Shubidok, Habibi. Stan Shui. Min Fadlik, Shubitsiwi? The minute she heard any word she knew, however poorly used, she stopped crying. She thought the flight had been canceled entirely. She needed to be in El Paso for major medical treatment the next day. I said, you're fine, you'll get there. Who is picking you up? Let's call him. We called her son and I spoke with him in English. I told him I would stay with his mother till we got on the plane and would ride next to her, Southwest. She talked to him, then we called her other sons, just for fun. Then we called my dad. And he and she spoke for a while in Arabic and found out, of course, that they had 10 shared friends. Then I thought, just for the heck of it, why not call some Palestinian poets I know and let them chat with her? This all took about 2 hours. She was laughing a lot by then, telling about her life, patting my knee, answering questions. She put a sack of homemade Mahmoud cookies, little powdered sugar, crumbly mounds, stuffed with dates and nuts, out of her bag and was offering them to all the women at the gate. To my amazement, not a single woman declined one. It was like a sacrament. The traveler from Argentina, the mom from California, the lovely woman from Laredo, we were all covered with the same powdered sugar and smiling. There is no better cookie. And then the airline broke out the free beverages from huge coolers, and two little girls from our flight ran around serving us all apple juice. And they were covered with powdered sugar too. And I noticed my new best friend, by now we were holding hands, had a potted plant poking out of her bag, some medicinal thing with green furry leaves. Such an old country traveling tradition, always carry a plant. Always stay rooted to somewhere. And I looked around the gate of late and weary ones and thought, this is the world I want to live in, the shared world. Not a single person in this gate, once the crying of confusion stopped, seemed apprehensive about any other person. They took the cookies. I wanted to hug all these other women too. This can still happen anywhere. Not everything is lost. So that's that kind of openness, right? Maybe to work with everything as potential learning requires that openness. Okay, maybe I don't know what's going to happen. Maybe that learning requires having some openness, doesn't it? And there was that openness in that situation, which led into unexpected communal sharing of powdered sugared cookies and apple juice and connection, right? Something that, who would have known that would have happened? So it requires that openness, the imagination. Sometimes it requires, for certain situations, it requires support. It requires help. It requires someone who, if I'm in a difficult situation, I may not be able to take it as learning by myself. I might require a guide, a teacher. You know, at this retreat that I was helping with, there were quite a number of people who had trauma come up in their practice. Very hard to deal with that themselves. Very hard to take trauma arising as a learning experience, right? Because it tends to shut people down. And so they needed some support, some guide, some help from people who knew how to work with that, you know, knew how to take that arising of this intense pain from the past and frame it as learning. So sometimes we need help, sometimes we need support. So I could say a lot more about this theme. It's a wonderful way to frame things, just to remember, can I take this as learning? Can I take this as something to open to? Can I watch my habitual tendencies to frame everything as either a curse or a blessing? Can I use the power of awareness to keep some space around it? Notice my reactions, notice my patterns. Can I hold some compassion for the way I might typically close things down, or the way other people do, or the way other people don't want to listen to my views? Can I hold that with some compassion and still keep learning from it? So my invitation would be, if this resonates with you, would be for the next week to take that intention to learn from everything and bring it up in the morning. Bring it up before a difficult conversation, right? Bring it to work. Bring it to a situation, especially one that's in the workable range. Maybe take situations where people have different views and try out that practice. Let me take this as an inquiry. Oh, why do I have this reaction? Oh, is there something to learn from this person? Watch the habitual tendencies. See if one can create space for a different kind of response. Mostly take everything as learning. So that's it. So let me invite any reflections or sharings or questions that anyone has related to this theme. We have a lot, yeah, so I see 5 hands already. So please, I'll start with Patty. Yeah. And let's say her names.
Patty, yeah. I don't think this was the context in which you meant it, because it wasn't really self-inquiry, but I had a very difficult boss once.
Yeah.
And I used her as a negative role model.
Yeah.
So I basically learned a lot, but it wasn't really learning about my own habits. habits. It was learning to take everything she did and do the opposite in my career. Treating people differently from the way she treated people. Responding in professional situations differently from the way she responded. And I really learned a lot from her, but not in the sense of, not in this more wise Buddhist perspective, just from a practical business thing.
Yeah.
I learned how to be with her by watching her carefully and trying to model the opposite.
Well, do you think that fits in what I'm basically suggesting?
It's related, but I don't think it's the same thing. No, it wasn't really self-inquiry at all. It was just a survival skill, certainly. Yeah. I felt like I learned from her.
But there, I think there might be some aspects of it that do fit in, because it's, you weren't simply resting in harsh blaming of this person. You weren't simply resting in harsh judgment, but you were saying, oh, let me look at this, what can I learn? And, you know, in, maybe if you would do something like that now, in due time, you might see something, there might be some compassion. Oh, I have my ways that I'm a little bit shut down too. Or I'm, you know, a lot of it is just to, you know, a lot of the learning, I think, is connected with something like compassion. You know, where we see, because as, you know, as we... something like the practice of looking at views, if we really look at why do I have this view, it's hard not to go to why does this person have some view, this view. And we might see that there's a very limited view for some reason. We might have compassion or understanding. So I think that anytime there's some openness beyond our simple reactions, we move in that direction. So I would interpret what you're saying as going there some, you know. But it's interesting, yeah. We had in the back. And what's their names too?
Listen.
Yeah.
You read the poem and it brought up a question that I've sort of pondered recently, and I'm not sure where the question comes into this. Recently I went over to the city on the ferry, and with virtually no exception, everyone, regardless of age, had a smartphone and was buried in their smartphone. And I looked around and I thought, oh my God, these people are completely isolated from themselves, from us, from everybody else. And it was scary to see how everyone was totally absorbed in their own little tiny world. And they weren't relating to anything other than that piece of communications in their hands.
Mm-hmm.
And I've noticed this. This has come up now several times when I go over on the boat and, you know, I see. And it's scary to think that we are so different than the point. The point is a complete 180 degrees opposite.
Mm-hmm.
From what I experience, you know, going over on the boat. And it, to me, I don't know what I can learn from that. And I'm still, you know, trying to absorb that information. And anyway,
yeah.
That's really all I can say.
Yeah,
our whole society, it's getting
to. So a situation of having... noticing large number of people on smartphones, and could be on the boat or it could be on BART, or and you know, interpreting it as about isolation in certain ways, and the question is, how can I take that as learning, right? Anyone have a response? I could give a response, but we see. Yeah,
I have a story that's to that. I was recently flying someplace and we had a delay of 3 hours, and then they told us the plane had been canceled. So we're all standing in line to get sent to the next level. And a lot of people are standing around with their phones, of course. And there was a guy behind me, and I just started talking to him, this Latino guy. We were going to Central America and he was going to El Salvador. And he told me that his mother had just died, and he was trying to get back to a funeral and that kind of stuff. he got tears in his eyes. And I said, my mother just died. And so this story is true. Just on the other side of those phones, these people are feeling. They're alive. It's just not so obvious to you.
Yep.
All it takes is a question.
And I don't disagree with what you say. They are alive. They're human beings. But what drives people?
Well, let me say one way to go with that kind of situation, because it's maybe not so different from being with someone with different views, or just let's say being in a situation which you interpret as having some problematic aspects, let's say. And one way is just to watch how your mind's working, that it is tending to polarize in some way. It's tending to go to an interpretation. And so really to track one's own mind, that's one way we learn. What is happening with my own mind now? Am I going to a certain interpretation? I'm tending to polarize. I'm tending to make this into a... there's something negative happening with these people, right? Mm-hmm. And to notice that. And so that's one aspect, really, to notice what's going on with one's mind. And it doesn't mean that your interpretation or analysis is necessarily off or wrong. It might, but that's for you to inquire into. But to notice what's happening with the mind, generally with another person, and I think this is your name again, was?
Yeah.
That I think part of maybe where Bill was going is that it always is helpful when there are other people to make the empathic move, right? And again, it doesn't mean that you change your analysis, but one can try to move, try to understand what's happening from within them, you know. And that can be an aspect of learning, because there can be a polarization. I was thinking of experience that I had where I once was with a group of people. We did a retreat. I think I may have talked about this once or twice. We did a retreat at Los Alamos National Laboratory. We stayed at campgrounds, and they let us be on the grounds of Los Alamos. And it was, you know, everyone there was more or less thought it was a good idea for nuclear weapons to be much less part of our nation, right? We shared that view. We had lunch every day with people who worked there, and we talked with them. And that was very interesting. Some of the people in our group actually could not really dialogue. Their views were so strong they could not dialogue with the people. And it was very interesting for me to try to be empathic and listen to them and see what was there, right? So that's a way to go with that situation. One can always be empathic. Again, it doesn't mean you give up your view, but it would be a way to learn from the situation. Like, you know, this is a human being. There's something that's meaningful for this person. What is it? Right, until you could go, that'd be a direction to go. Not easy, right, in those situations. But yeah, we have a lot of hands, like 4 or 5 hands. And we should probably do the meta cards at what time? About
Alex doing those tonight.
Do it.
I would strike.
About five of. But that's
yeah. Cool. Yeah. That's tons of time. There's only, it's going to take me 2 minutes.
So I can do a little bit before 8.
Perfect.
We have another 10 minutes or so.
Perfect.
Let me go from, I see 1, 2, 3, and then was it Arthur?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I see 4. Okay. Please, yeah.
Hi, I'm Natalie. I was just wondering how we're looking at the word learning.
Yeah.
Because I don't think you mean to build an opinion.
Yeah.
Another, like in Buddhism, a head on top of a head.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah.
I had a recent experience where I got my feelings hurt.
Yeah.
And I was open in that situation.
Yeah.
And I took some criticism that hurt.
Yeah.
Because I was so open. It was very vulnerable at that point. And it's so easy for me, well, it's that person. I'll never be open again with that person.
Yeah.
And I still don't know how to totally resolve it.
Yeah.
That, and I can see where she's coming from. In a way, she's in a difficult situation too.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I'm just needing help with that.
Yeah, that's a great and helpful question. What do I mean by learning?
Yeah.
And as I was listening, I was thinking, yeah, what I mean is that we frame experience as part of spiritual practice.
Yeah,
because the aim of spiritual practice is to keep learning. Again, the understanding is that the root issue is ignorance. So it's learning about myself, learning about my reactions, learning how to respond, learning about the nature of the mind. But it's framed in terms of our practice.
Yeah.
You know, which again we could talk about different kinds of insights, but that's the kind of learning it is. So it's learning that ultimately is transformational, that moves us to develop the qualities of mindfulness, wisdom, compassion. Yeah. Another way we could say it is that I'm learning about these core qualities, right? I'm learning how to be more, have more wisdom, more awareness, more compassion, more skillful response. So that'd be how I would answer first. Yeah. So it's not learning this or that fact or
Yeah, because the word learning,
yeah,
most people take it as a thinking thing.
Thinking, yeah. Yeah, so that's helpful to clarify. Well, please, yeah.
Laura, and I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you can practice this type of learning with good things, like things that you label as good and
right.
Going well.
Yeah, how to keep learning even when good things are happening. Well, it relates to what I was mentioning as the core habitual psychology, which is that with good things we grab hold, we're not aware. With so-called bad things we push away and we're not aware, that we're just in the habitual reaction. So it would be actually, it could be to inquire. Mostly, so it's to bring in mindfulness. You know, it depends what the good thing is. Let's say I'm doing work that I love, something like that. So what would it mean to learn there? Could mean a few things. It could mean to really be mindful of what I'm doing. It could be to ask, what do I love? Or it could be to tune in to joy, tune into the quality of happiness or joy, which often we're not so aware of. So it could be, which actually could heighten our sense of the goodness of it. It could be to appreciate it. It could be to reflect on the positive learning that's occurring. Those would be some things. But so it would partly to be that, and then partly to watch the habitual tendencies with something quote-unquote good, which would be to often not to be aware, to grab the grabbing hold in the mind or in action, and to watch that, and to really to have, to remember that if we take learning as the intention, another way of saying that is, can I moment to moment be aware when there are good things happening, when there are so-called bad things happening, and can I keep being present? And can I keep being open, rather than saying, "Oh, this is good," and kind of losing awareness? Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. Need to go there, and then Arthur, and then over here. Yeah. People will get there. Yeah. Please.
So I had a similar experience in the financial district. You know, people with their headphones in all the time, and we're on Buddhist retreat, my first Buddhist retreat, you know, nobody would meet eyes or anything. It was like the most unfriendly world to walk through. And what I realized, and this took a long time, was the trigger for me was that I was looking for some connection. And I wanted to meet these people's eyes, to not be ignored on the street. To be recognized and acknowledged. Mm-hmm. And that was really helpful to get to that spot.
Yeah. So that's a great point also in response to your question. It's like, if I'm, you know, rather than get too lost in the judging or the blaming, to actually, that typically is a cover for my own pain, right? And actually to know this is painful for me, right? Or I feel disconnected. And so that actually deepens it. You know, and you know what I found in working with the judgmental mind is that the judgmental mind typically covers over unacknowledged pain. And that actually when we can touch what's beneath it, things open up and they deepen. You know, and this is something that we can, that's hard to do. You know, so we actually use judgments and blaming as a kind of defense mechanism so we actually don't feel the pain more. That's interesting. Please, well, I think maybe two more, and then we'll move to our card. So Arthur, and then on the side. Yeah.
There are times that we believe our own perception.
Yeah.
The environment is clear. It's a sunny day. We see something, and that which we see, we take as truth because it seems so crystal clear.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't necessarily have to be that the real truth of the situation is arising because of what we see. It seems to me that life is story a lot of the time. Years ago, when I was beginning to think I was learning something about psychology, I learned about transactional analysis, and it was like a pool table. This ball hit that ball, this did that, this led to that action, and there was an explanation. It was really very far from the truth. But I didn't know that because the explanation seemed to me very complete. If you go back 30, 40 years, if you were on the East Coast and you were traveling in from Long Island into Manhattan, everybody was holding up the New York Times. I mean, the train was blanketed. Didn't make a difference what section they were reading, but they were learning. They were attached to the dominant better paper and of the time. And I mean it. There wasn't a New York Post. There was no other paper. It was the New York Times. That cell phone could be a medium whereby what you in the moment saw as disconnection, because in that moment people weren't relating. And they weren't. I give that to you completely. But maybe some of them were relieving stress by playing a game because they knew that the work environment that they were in was going to be damn difficult that day. Some of them were learning and reading something. Some of them were catching up on work that they didn't complete. There are 1,000 explanations. And we can choose the explanation which is apparent to us, or we can choose just to look, be in wonderment, and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so I suggest you take another ferry.
So that sense of openness, really, and to note again, to notice one's own tendencies to make something fixed and closed, and to somehow move to more openness. You brought in the notion of wonder, which is close to what I was invoking with the sense of imagination earlier, where that sense of the know me, she have no I story, right? She entered in that situation, which, you know, on the surface just like looked like another 4-hour delay at the airport. And yet a certain kind of response brought out something magical. And really was also inviting the imagination. Oh, maybe that person is just having this great time with this video game on the smartphone and is really just building resources for a difficult work day. maybe your scenario. So it's a kind of empathy, a kind of use of the imagination, right? That's challenging for us often. And there are aspects, I think, that there might be, I'm sympathetic to some ways that the way we use the media may be problematic as well. So it's not to, all of these go together. Okay, last one.
I'm Dalton.
Yeah,
and, hi. My ultimate motivation for doing anything is to feel good. And seeking greater awareness is ideally what the goal would be, because the payoff would be that I would feel good from seeking greater awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to get in alignment with reality.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. So it's, I think that's a helpful way to frame it. It's really, to, I think, really to inquire into that, because I think when you talk about feeling good, you're talking, maybe we're talking about happiness or well-being.
Physically, emotionally, spiritually.
And what we find is that there really are different levels of feeling good, right? And we may be looking for a deep sense of feeling good. And obviously we know that the feeling good of eating a lot of sugar only goes so far, right? Right, and so it's really a question of what kind of feeling good is the deeper aspiration. And so I think in the kind of practice which we're suggesting here, that sense of feeling good and, you know, can be connected with joy, with happiness, and it's connected with inner freedom and with wisdom and love and a kind heart, right?
Self-esteem.
Yeah, that could be an aspect of it at a certain point. So it's, so the inquiry question is, how can I keep that that horizon of the deepest sense of feeling good, and be aware that on the way there may be some ways that I feel good, but they may be limited, and how can I keep going and not take a limited sense of feeling good that blocks me from deeper senses.
Well, it's my distorted awareness that keeps me from expanding.
Yeah. So I think if we keep a certain openness and a certain questioning, and we say, okay, well, this feels pretty good now, but let me look. What's my experience? What's my thinking? And I think we basically just keep moving, you know, and what we know from developmental studies is that we sort of stabilize it at certain levels, and ideally we keep going. And sometimes we need to almost destabilize a certain way of seeing things in order to go deeper. You know, we can see that, you know, in terms of, I don't know, being a teenager, growing up, going through midlife crisis, whatever, that the learning sometimes has to challenge previous views. And how to just keep that sense of learning and keep that sense of openness. That's really what I'm suggesting today.
And the learning isn't the what is the payoff for the learning?
In multiple traditions that we can call wisdom traditions, the payoff is wisdom, freedom, love, sort of deep.
And the result of that is what?
Deep actualization. It's basically using one's own gifts and what you've been given in an optimal way for one's own benefit and the benefit of others. It's one way to say it. And so it's very personal, but we tend to, you know, in this particular approach, what my mind tends to do is I tend to go to a list, you know, a group of qualities that are, you know, in the Buddhist tradition, there's one of the teachings is the teaching of the awakened factors. When a mind is free, awake, full of love, these qualities tend to manifest. As we would talk about mindfulness and energy and wisdom, you know, actually there's seven factors in the model. We probably could talk about others, but their qualities like compassion, wisdom, energy, peace of mind, tranquility, skillful actions, and so forth. These tend to manifest. So that would be one way of talking about it. And so it's really the question of how can I keep learning so those qualities get stronger and stronger. That's another way of framing what I've been talking about today. How can I keep developing in these core qualities? Thank you, Dalton.